Welcome everyone to the monthly meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison. Leah has worked on the low-power FM station, and if no one objects, we might even use this recording on that radio station at some point. Our speaker today is Andy Summers, who is a member of this congregation, and he's been kind enough to come and talk to us on a topic that he restrained himself from talking about when he was talking to the congregation of this church. I hope he feels free to tell us everything he couldn't say then. On the topic of religious propaganda. How to recognize it and handle it. Andy, I understand you're a retired judge, among other things. Is there more that you'd like to say to introduce yourself?
Oh, that's about it. I was kind of a reformed Catholic, or recovering Catholic, I guess. And so I recognize a lot about propaganda. Uh-huh. When I spoke to the UU Church about propaganda, I had a lot of fun with my little talk, but I did get to a point where I said, you know, one of the most powerful forms of propaganda that we have, in every form, is religious propaganda. And I said, I'm not going to touch it. We have a principle in the UU Church not to anyway ridicule or anything, another religion, or we're supposed to tolerate and so on. And I have a tendency sometimes, I cross the line. And I had one program one time where I got a whole religious group mad at me because I didn't know it. But I somehow made fun of a rabbit. And I found out later that was a symbol in this particular church, and the people were going to kill me. But they didn't kill me. I think they left the church.
The rabbit was a symbol?
Yeah, to me the rabbit was, you're pregnant. If the rabbit dies, you're pregnant. Isn't that how it works? Okay, well, that's for a younger group, I'm sorry. So I had a hesitation. But my talk on propaganda went into, there were so many areas where religions were the source of propaganda. The word propaganda comes from propagation of the faith. And in the 1600s, I think it was Pope Gregory set up a committee called the Propagation of the Faith, whose job was to establish missionaries throughout the world to bring God's word. That committee must be without a termination date, because it keeps on going, and it's still pretty powerful. When I grew up, there were so many forms of propaganda that I didn't recognize. They're still with me. I went to a little secular school in Brooklyn, and most of the teachers were Catholic, Roman Catholic. But it was presumably every Protestant school. And we sang hymns in the morning, in Brooklyn. It was called Froebel Academy. It was named after
the private school.
Well, yeah, I don't like to. My wife says
when you said secular, I thought you said a public school.
No, it wasn't. It was a lot of rich kids, snotty kids. And a lot of us were trouble at home, and, you know, they sent us to straighten us out. But we learned these hymns, and they stayed with me. One, it scared the hell out of me. Every morning we'd get up and we'd sing, "Work for the Night is Coming." I don't know if you people remember that hymn or heard it. It's a story about some guy out in the field who works until he dies. And apparently he just dies in the field. Work for the night is coming when man works no more. And it so scared me. Singing this song, I decided never to work. And I became a lawyer, you know. But But those are, I laugh because I look back and these things are still with me. I mean, if nobody told me I had to memorize them, but I just remember them. I walked into Ward Box the other day. As I came in, they're playing recorded music. They're playing Holy, Holy, Holy. And I found myself singing along. I remember the words, Lord God Almighty, God in three persons. I said, wait a minute.
That's the Trinity.
That's the Trinity. You know, I grew up as a kid and I learned that song. I had the faintest idea what the hell I was singing. I didn't know what I was adhering to. And people died over that principle of whether they believed in three gods in one, or three people in one, or three something in one. And it was a big issue, and here I was buzzing along with the words without having any recognition whatsoever. This was drummed into me early. Early on, I learned this. And to me, that propaganda, the only definition of it is a message. People create messages intending you in some way to act or to think or to believe in a certain way. And one of the most startling, you know, when you think about it, the great difficulty we have today, we, you know, you use are such pussycats. We don't believe in, really. Our idea of a protest would be to put up a little sign or something saying boo. But we can't walk on the grass. So we can't have a revolution. But the this idea of tolerating, and I'm all for it. I believe in tolerating, except when the people on the other side are whacking me over the head. You know, and then I'm told, as people are whacking me over the head, that Jesus said, turn your other cheek. And I say, well, okay, what happens when you turn the other cheek and you get whacked there too? You know, but there's a group out there. Now, I brought three books, three lovely books. The nice thing about giving a talk is it gives you a chance to review your topic and to pretend to be an expert. And I had a lot of misgivings about this because I'm talking not to the choir, I'm really talking to the Vatican here, because you people know so much more about this stuff than I do. So I don't pretend to be any kind of expert. But when I was doing my other talk, it was so much fun because I went back to revisit old friends, Harper Lee, you know, the books like that in which propaganda came out, Uncle Tom's Cabin and so on. And I took my talk as to the positive side of propaganda. Well, when I started this one, I didn't really have any position one way or the other, and I find myself getting scared by what I was reading. Now, one of the Chicken Littles, who's yelling the sky is falling, she has a good right to yell the sky is falling, is a gal named Michelle Goldberg, who wrote this book called Kingdom Coming. And it's called The Rise of Christian Nationalism. One of the reasons she has a little bit of fear, I guess, is she's Jewish. And she recognizes, with all this right-wing religious stuff going on, most of it does not include Jewish people. And she gets this terrible feeling that maybe we should step up and shout. I was in Belfast one time, and I turned on the radio and I heard some British commentator saying, the method we have of reaching democracy is to bring the two Christian communities together. I said, you know, there's something wrong with that. I thought about it. I'm kind of slow. And I have to think about things for a while. I said, you know, if I were Jewish and I heard that, I'd be a little upset about bringing the two Christian communities together. But in Belfast, that was the thinking by the ruling class at the time. There are two religions, two phases of religion. There's Protestant religion and the wrong one. That was their decision on how life was. The poor Muslims up in Belfast now are in terrible times, as are Seventh-day Adventists and Christian Zionists, whatever. They are in a terrible time because they're not even recognized as being people. Voltaire was the one. He was kind of a favorite of mine, but because he was an iconoclast, and he raised a lot of hackles. He disturbed a lot of the people in the church, the Catholic Church. He raised and trained by the Jesuits, and the Jesuits used to say that if they trained you, you would either turn out to be a genius or an evil person. I was trained by the Jesuits. I'm not sure which side I read. But at any rate, Voltaire came out and said that we will not have peace until the last politician is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. That did not get him much favor with the government. And the only sad thing about Voltaire is he was a tough cookie. But at the end, he became very fearful about where he was going to be buried and how he was going to be buried. And he tried to make peace with the church somehow. Although he was, the other anecdote was that he was asked to renounce the devil on his deathbed, and he said, "This is no time for making new friends." But
new friends.
He did try to make peace with the Catholic Church so he would get a Christian burial. And that's the one thing they would hold over your head. And they finally, after he died, he didn't get what he wanted. He did not get a good burial. He was buried in a monastery, outside of a monastery, in kind of quiet circumstances. But that was the power that the church would have over you, to deny you even in death. I mean, they would get to your relatives. But that is the some of the symbols that we've seen about propaganda and how it's reacted in our lives, and how we've allowed ourselves to believe a lot of these things. There are two quotes I have now, and I'm not sure where they came from, but somebody here might know. One was a philosopher was musing on the fact that they were having all this difficulty in trying to discover what God was and who God was. They reflected on the fact that there was a woman in India who would rise every morning and go down to the river Ganges, bathe herself, and know that she was saved. They're still doing this. They're still part of their religion. Even though that, from what I understand, that river is the most foul and filthy river going, but the people down there bathing themselves every day in the belief that that's all you have to do. Now, the philosopher was opining, he says, you know, amusing. Why are we going through all this stress and thought? And look at this woman. Look what she does. And she's happy. But what he didn't answer was that he couldn't do the same thing. He was not equipped to say to himself, I've got to go jump in the river. I mean, he had this inquiring mind. He had to keep going. And it was not enough for him to go down to the river, even though many, many people accepted. The other thing was, this is a quote, and again, I don't know where it came from. It might have been Nietzsche, who said, if there was no God, man would create one. And one of the things we have to realize, that for those of us who may be uncertainties or agnostics or atheists or ambiguous, whatever we are, that religion is a powerful factor for good in our lives. I often wondered if there, say to myself, if there were no God, why am I being good? You know, why don't I go beat up my neighbor, you know, and the weaker ones, the smaller ones. But what is it that's keeping me good? You know, when I, situational ethics, when I get a chance to steal in the dark where nobody's looking, what would stop me? What would be that little voice? And that, I think, is probably one of the most powerful arguments for the religion and for religious principles. We learn certain things. And because I find myself in the dark, and there's nothing there to steal. But when I grew up as a kid, the propaganda I had, I grew up in Brooklyn, and I was taught there were Catholics and non-Catholics, two terms. Just like I could have been in Belfast and you'd heard about the two Christian communities. Well, we didn't even have two Christian communities in Brooklyn, you know, and I think, and I criticized the British. In Brooklyn, according to my mother, there were Catholics and non-Catholics. Everybody in the world was in that non-Catholic situation. And mostly, that would mean Protestant or Jewish, because we didn't know there was anybody else. And that's, and there were no people of color. We're all Anglo-Saxon, and we were all kind of in a protected little area. It was only when I got to law school that I suddenly found out there were other people in this world. I mean, I got through with Catholic education and I went out to a secular law school, and most of my fellow students were Jewish, and I no longer heard anything about St. Thomas Aquinas. I thought that was amazing, because back at St. John's, if you'd ask these Dominicans what time it was, they would say, you know, St. Thomas. Everything was St. Thomas. Like he was. But all of a sudden I was in law school and I never heard a thing about St. Thomas. And it was just, I appreciated it. But
Andy, when did you start law school?
1957. Back in the, they had the electric lights and things back then. We didn't have iPods and we didn't have any of that stuff.
But they had lots of Jews, Protestants, and black people.
Not in my
in
area.
New York.
Not in Crown
not
Heights.
Not his neighbor.
And not where I grew up. Later on, the surge came. But in my little area, and my mother would not let me go anywhere. You got to remember this. I had an Irish mother who would not let me go too far. And where there might
you
be other
go
people.
Far at all.
Yeah, I didn't go to Flatbush Avenue. I didn't go to any of these places. So I was in a little protected area. At any rate, that the story is that I thought there were just two kinds of people, Catholic and Protestants. And you know, the big fight we have today was a group that is taking over. And here's why we should get a little excited. Not only is this group, which is a minority group, very powerfully connected today, but they keep pushing. And they look for legislation, and they look for court decisions, and they look for legislators for their point of view. One of the big myths they say is that there's a separation between church and state. They go back to the Constitution and say there's nothing in there about that. It's all words by Jefferson, it's all words by the U.S. Supreme Court, and I have to laugh because this same group, one of their biggest devils is something called activist judges, which I don't know what an act. I would imagine an activist judge is one who's kind of alive, you know, and who asks a question, and he, but at any rate, it was the U.S. Supreme Court that finally got into the First Amendment and applied it in such a way that to protect us against established religions. When we started off, the religious right is correct. A lot of the groups who came to our country were bigoted religious people who had no tolerance for anybody. The Puritans were bastards, and I mean, they would torture, they would kill. If you were a dissenter, you risked your life. There was a man named Roger Williams who got kicked out of Massachusetts, went to Rhode Island to start to keep the religion going. I think he was Catholic. But just remember back in those days, we had the Salem witch trials. We had people being killed for whatever. The original settlers in America were not tolerant people. They were running away from a lot of Church of England and a lot of forced religions. But they weren't too tolerant. They hated, for instance, the Baptists. The Baptists got beaten up wherever they went. And it was only when we finally got together and formed the Constitution, with people like George Mason insisting that we have a Bill of Rights and that we have protection for the people against established religions and so on, that the doctrine came forth. We hear today from these people that we are a Christian nation. And I don't know why we're a Christian nation. I mean, we had this drummed down to it all the way through. The funny thing is they can't define what a Christian is. They don't know what a Christian is. We've got a man running for president now, and the debate is just starting a little bit as to whether he's a Christian or not. George Romney's son, Mitron. He's a Mormon. Is he a Christian? What is the definition of Christian? One who accepts Christ, I guess. But at any rate, there's so many people under that umbrella that if you ascribe or you give in to that thought that we are a Christian nation, you immediately start causing trouble for the fringe groups, one of which, by the way, is us. There are a lot of people who don't think the UU is a Christian. They think we're devil worshippers and whatever. But that's the big question, is what is a Christian nation? And these fights are going on. These fights are going on in our courts, in our school boards, in our legislatures. And these people are shoving this stuff down our throat. Now, as I said before, we can be tolerant. But when somebody pushes through constitutional amendments relating to who can get married and who can't, when they push through referendums on the right to life, but maybe the right to kill people too, I get a little concerned, because I think it was Justice Jackson in the Supreme Court recognized and talked about the Bill of Rights. He said the Bill of Rights is not does not set up protections which are to be bargained or compromised or voted on. The protections are not to be the will of the majority. The protections are protecting the rights of the minority, and these are not subject to a popular vote. But it is difficult today, because we go through the different rages, which, for their own purposes, some of these groups engage. War rage, it's not just one party, because during the First World War, we had a Democrat named Woodrow Wilson who pushed us into a war rage and got us to hate Germans for some reason. Nobody wanted to hate Germans, but he pushed us into the First World War, so we had no reason to be there. The one everybody likes, the guy with the teddy bear, pushed us in wars against Spain and so on, that we had no reason to have. But so war rage is a one thing, but religious propaganda is encouraging hatred, division, and scary stuff today. When the entire Congress comes back to session and the president flies back because of some comatose woman in Florida, and the entire nation stops so they could vote as to whether or not the doctors could remove the feeding tube, we're in a lot of trouble. We almost had a constitutional crisis, by the way, on that, because Jeb Bush sent — Jeb is one of the lesser Bushes, the Shrubs. He was president of president, whatever the Florida people think of. He sent the state officers to the hospice to put the feeding tube back, and the local policemen stopped them, and it could have been — and then he called back the state officers — there could have been a constitutional breakdown at that point, and nobody knew there was that. You know, we know about George Wallace standing in the schoolhouse or Lester Maddox with a pickaxe, but we never heard that much about Jeb Bush. We never really heard the other side of what the hell was going on in Florida. We had a majority leader in the Senate get up, who was the doctor. This same doctor said you could get AIDS through tears. I like that one. We couldn't allow people who had AIDS to cry. But he said he looked at the pictures and he knew that woman was all right. I said, holy, this is my kind of doctor. You know, I want a doctor like this that can look at a picture and say, hey, you're okay. But I tried to write out some notes so I'd know what I was talking about. Oh, the other two books that I would suggest, the one I recommend is Kingdom Coming. Hitchens, who a guy — I don't like Hitchens. I thought he was always a wise man. But he wrote a good book on God Is Not Great. And I would recommend that. And his topic — this was drive the right wing crazy — How Religion Poisons Everything. That's the subtitle. And he goes into the whole history of religion, religious conflicts, and this is a very good book to read. The other one is Gone on Trial by Peter Irons, who is a constitutional lawyer and professor, and he talks about all the legal challenges that have gone on involving God, which kind of makes you funny. If God is so powerful, why does he need a lawyer? But the there are challenges every day. These people, it's, again, I was at a church function about a week ago, and I think they were Baptists. They didn't call themselves Baptists. They called themselves something else. Anyway, they're so happy and such good people, and you know, everybody looked so friendly, and I enjoyed myself, and the food was great. And I said, you know, nobody brought up gay marriage. Nobody brought up contraception. And nobody brought up AIDS or abortion. But everybody just talked about how the kids are growing, you know. And I said, this is the way life should be. We should never have to talk about all those little nasty things. But there are a lot of people out there who not only have their own ideas, but they want you to have their own ideas. Or they are so convinced that because God talked to them, that it's their mission to enforce those ideas on the godless and those people who don't have a telephone. Now they have Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell. They had their own telephone from God. And I used to think that when you talk to God, it's called prayer. When God talks to you, I would call that schizophrenia. But Falwell and Robertson had their own conversations with God, and some of the things they came out with is just amazing. They blamed 9/11 on gay people. I said, you know, I hadn't heard of any of those people on the plane who were gay. I knew they were from Saudi Arabia, but they may have been some. But at any rate, he blamed it all on gay people and our promiscuity and abortion and whatever. The two of them had a grand old time finding out why 9/11. So with this new administration, we're finding more and more laws and more religious principles enforced in this country, which has separation of church and state. We really don't have it anymore, because Mr. Bush has made sure that a lot of funds, which used to go just to charities, now go to faith-based charities. Now, nobody's given me a list of those faith-based charities, but I can bet that there aren't too many UUs on there, and there aren't too many Jewish people on there, and there are, damn right, there's no Muslims, you know, because Bush is always not against all Muslims. It's just against 99% of them. What is a faith-based organization? They're getting one hell of a lot of money. The other thing they pushed through, and I don't know whether it was Bush or whether the Congress or how they did this, but we had the court saying that charities, if they took federal money, had to live up to the laws of this country, one of which was non-discrimination. And that was one of the big things that the right wanted to get rid of. I mean, the fact that Liberty College would have to hire a homosexual would, you know, completely destroy anything. When in some of these universities, and one of the universities that got hurt was Bob Jones University. They were decertified for a while because they couldn't get any federal funds. Because they are the greatest discriminating group going. For a while, they didn't even allow mixed couples to date, couples of different races to date. I don't know. I think they're probably getting the federal money now. That, by the way, was one of the first places that George Bush the Lesser went to make his opening speech. and his campaign for president was the Bob Jones University. It kind of gives you, and it's one that McCain has made peace with Bob Jones and Liberty. At one time he made comments about how bad Liberty was, which was started by, was that Falwell that started? Yeah. They start their own universities, and we don't realize how powerful this stuff is until in one of the congressional hearings they brought on a lovely little blonde airhead. I have nothing against blondes, by the way, I used to be one. But she was deputy attorney general, and her credentials were, she went to Liberty Law School and Messiah College. I said, holy shit, wow. And she had an awful lot of trouble interpreting the law and immunity and stuff. I said, wow, I wonder what they talked about back in law school, you know, and here. And I heard the justice had a lot of these people, and the U.S. Capitol had a lot of these people coming out of colleges like Liberty, and they're all over the place. So, you know, we talk about, again, we go back to tolerance. Yeah, I tolerate these people. My God, they're running the whole train. You know, pretty soon there's not going to be any room on that train for me. Religion, as propaganda, is always used by people in authority to get what they want or to get control over you. And that's one of the things I think we have to recognize. Now, I look at you people as being in the forefront of this, and I think one of the reasons Bob asked me to talk was I think you're recruiting new members, and I think you did a good Bob, because I'll join. And my wife is even being bragging about being a founding member of the maybe she'll join too, you know. Growing up too, as I said, when I was being taught that we were a Christian nation, I never asked what that meant. Somewhere along the line, somewhere around the 50s, they changed that. They being those people who spun the news. And we are no longer a Christian nation. We became a new term, which was Judea Christian, to recognize Jews. So we became a nation of Jews and Christians. Today, of course, we have so many other groups out there that have we don't reference, I mean, we'd have a hell of a time putting all those adjectives on. We'd never get to the word nation. But the dogma I was raised, I still have this stuff. And I still, all the stuff I was taught as the truth. And you couldn't question it. That was the wonderful, great thing. It was like the woman in the river. It couldn't question, you know. And every time I started to question something, I'd have some priest telling me that this is God's word. And, you know, I felt I had not much self-esteem anyway, and I didn't want to take on God. But little things like no fish on Friday. I said, you know, I accepted this for a long time, that this was, for some reason, God didn't eat fish. Or he ate fish. Or he didn't eat shellfish, or he didn't eat pork, or I don't know. God had the strangest habits, you know, as far as eating. I hate to have made up his menu, but that was the priests were introduced to me as messengers, direct messengers from God. Whatever they said, God said. And in the Catholic Church, we were protected from thinking. I like that because as little as I had to think, it gave me time to do other things. Chase girls and stuff, but
get a law degree.
Yeah, well, that was just a show off for the girls. We were told not to think, and we never had the Bible. You know, I hear people talking about the Bible today. I never saw the Bible. We didn't know what the Bible was. I know in every hotel I go, there's a Bible, and I open it up once in a while. Mary thought it was a state law. She said to me, she thought that the Bible being there was state law. I said, no, I don't know who this guy goes. I don't, there's some guy in the middle of the night from they got a Bible society.
Gideon.
And every
Gideon's,
yeah. They got, and that's what the joke I had is I opened it up and it says, lonely call, read Matthew 7, verse 3. So I turned to Matthew and it says, still lonely, call Gigi, 275. But I don't know who's putting those Bibles out there.
Gigi.
That's, Gigi. But we accept all this stuff. I don't find Hemingway in there. I don't find Orwell. I open up and I'd love to find some books by Hemingway or something. I find my little Bible, and I don't think anybody's. I don't know. Does anybody ever open one of those?
Gideon's?
The Bible in the hotels.
Bible?
Yeah. Because they use that as the best-selling book in the country.
They never say, but I've opened.
But I wonder how many read it.
I've opened them up to see if it says anything inside where they're distributed by. But
yeah.
Gideon's is the organization, and that's their sole purpose for existence is to have contracts with the hospitality industry, and the maids put them back in the room if they're missing, and the little thing in it says, take it if you want it.
Yeah.
We'll replace it here.
Well, I take the towels instead. I don't.
The more useful.
You still believe the practice ended?
A lot of it I do. It's so much in me that I still do. Let's put it this way: whether I believe it, I'm not challenging things. I'm not sitting around challenging the Trinity or something. I don't even know why I would challenge the Trinity. I don't know.
Because you're a Unitarian.
Yeah, but it doesn't bother me. Why would I challenge the Trinity?
Well, just being a Unitarian, you are challenging the Trinity.
But you're also.
What, do you think Calvin would probably stick me in one of those cages and set fire to me? I mean, they used to burn people.
Yeah.
I think I might. I don't know if I'd be that. I'd be that heroic. When they started the kindling wood onto me, I think I'd say, on second thought, let's talk about
it. I reach out to this
area.
Andy.
Yeah.
I heard you say that. God was useful because it kept you from killing your neighbor, or words to that effect.
Yeah, one or two names I like to kill.
Now, what if you hadn't been told all of your life that man was evil and it was only God that kept man from
The natural law.
Well, suppose you've been taught that man, and obviously it's as I see it, that man was good.
Yeah.
What would you need God for then?
Well, under the natural law, I think we all have within us an understanding of what is good and what's bad. It's the distinctions, the details where we have trouble.
The devil's
in the details. The devil's in the details. Because we say, oh, I love all man except the guy down the street, and maybe the guy over on the other side who just dumped something on my lawn. But I think naturally we have certain beliefs and tendencies. But on the other hand, we also have great evil in us, too, and I think I have to recognize that. I don't think the people in history, if you look at some of the great evil, what we call evil, were great religious figures. I don't think people like Hitler and Stalin or Mussolini or Genghis Khan or
Lenin.
We could go down a whole list. These were particularly religious people. They used the church in some ways, and they when they had to. But none of them seem to come off as a religious type person. So there are people out there who are capable of doing great evil. So that's a good argument. Where would we be without all these lessons that we get about what is good and what's bad and how we can be good? I I often think that just the doctrine that we don't look, want to look bad in front of our friends, or we don't want to look bad. I saw, that's a personal thing. My sister sent me a picture of an old picture, 1945. And my father was there and my brother. And my brother was just getting a medal. And my father was standing there, it was 1948. And he was standing there looking at the medal and looking at my brother. And I had this thought, you know, I never got a medal. And I never pleased my father that. You know, right away I said, you know, it was totally a stupid resentment. And a feeling of envy, I guess, of my brother being able to reach that. We have these feelings and emotions and strange things within us, regardless of what the church tells us. They're there. We have to recognize they're there. I guess one of the things the church tried to do is to channel our activities in a goodly fashion to make good whatever out of us. The only problem is, as we said before, the devil's in the details. When I found out my church, the Catholic Church, was not at all active in the civil rights movement. And when I went to try and talk to black people in New York about getting on the bandwagon for Irish human rights, I met a lot of resistance. And I found out why. Because these people remember Boston and Chicago, and it was the Irish that were throwing rocks. And they were the ones who were trying to deny black people civil rights. And now it's a little ironic that the Irish would come to them. And that was the fault, not only the Irish people, Irish American people, but the church. The Irish Catholic Church never spoke out.
Yes. What about
Can I? Go ahead.
All right.
You're very negative and have some very deep resentments, I assume, against the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to say something, devil's advocate, maybe that's not what it is, but I want to say a word here for the Catholic Church. And it's not that I'm defending them on all bases and so forth, but I'm not sure they're any better or worse than other religions. Now, I grew up as an Episcopalian, and as a child, 4 years old, when my mother went out looking for an apartment, the only person who would rent her an apartment was a Polish Catholic family. Mm-hmm. And we lived with these people in a two-flat house, like one family, for 15 or 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
They were Catholic, well, my mother sent me to the Episcopal Church, but my father didn't. He hated religion, and he didn't spare any words telling people that. We were not really churchgoers. We participated in everything that family did. They participated in everything we did, except that the church would not allow them to go into a Protestant church. Mm-hmm. So there were two occasions when there was a young girl in the family who was exactly my age, and we were best friends all from the time we were 5 years old until we were married. She could not come to my wedding, mm-hmm. and she could not come to my confirmation.
Mm-hmm. No.
I understood that. That's what her religion required of her. That had nothing to do with how we felt about each other or how we acted toward each other in other ways. Now, then I went to a Catholic college, and I started college in 1947, and I was never proselytized in that school. I did not have to take the courses on religion. I never had people who were coming up trying to tell me how much better the Catholic religion was from. It was not a topic of conversation. The Catholic students took courses that dealt with Catholicism. but I didn't have to. And there was never any stigma on the fact that I was not doing this. The Catholic organizations were the ones who were trying to integrate the skating rinks and the swimming pools and so forth in New Jersey, where I lived. And I don't remember the other churches being involved in that. They also encouraged young black kids who had the ability to go to Catholic schools. The Catholic schools in my neighborhood, there were a lot of minority kids who went to those schools because they were welcomed there and they got a good education. And then I taught in a Catholic high school. Again, when I was looking for a job, it was the Catholic high school and the nuns, the Sisters of Charity in that school, who hired me. And when my kids got out of hand, and I had one little boy who in church one day screamed the N-word out to me, and she took that kid by his collar and pulled him into the office and practically threw him out of school. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I just, there are good people and bad people in every religion. There's good and bad in every religion.
I agree with you on that. But the thing, I don't criticize people who have a certain religious
thought. But you're criticizing
the church. I'm criticizing the hierarchy. When I say the church, mm-hmm. I'm criticizing the hierarchy. I saw this in Ireland. I saw that the Irish individual priests were wonderful. The bishops were terrible. They sided with the British because that's where they got their money. And they excommunicated Catholics for being part of the revolutionary movement in the Northern Ireland because they did not want people to revolt against the authority. That's part of the reason I guess I'm negative, because hierarchies of this church, which are teaching rules, and I don't know where they come from. And my criticism, too, is for the people who accept these rules. You met some wonderful people. That's great.
Well, it wasn't just the people, the church itself. I mean, I guess what I'm not refuting what you're saying about the church,
no.
But I'm just saying I think there's another side
to it,
and I wouldn't want everybody to get the impression.
I just know that when the civil rights thing came up, some of the greatest furor. The point I was making is when I was trying to get black people to jump on the Irish civil rights movement, I ran into a lot. I never got any of them to say yes. And I had to realize Boston and Chicago were vicious places. And it was the Irish in South Boston.
Yeah,
it was the Irish in Chicago. And this was tough. Where were these great principles about love and Jesus and, you know, where were the priests standing up saying, let's bring Martin into our churches and talk to him? These are the things that really pissed me off. And that's one of the reasons I've been bitter, because I've had hypocrisy. I've grown up with hypocrisy. It took me a long time to question authority. It took me the Vietnam War. After the Vietnam War, up until then, I didn't question any authority. I was the authority. I worked for the DA's office. I was a prosecutor. I was prosecuting kids who were walking up and down the street because I was part of the culture that ruled. And it was only after that that I started to question.
I'd like to ask a question. And it's partly a challenge of your thoughts here, but you talk about the Irish were the ones who threw the stones at the black folks back in the
South Boston.
In Chicago and probably all over the country. And yet I've traveled a little bit in Northern Ireland, and I can remember in the Catholic section of Belfast, they have these huge murals.
Oh yeah.
There's one. Well, there's probably several for Leonard Peltier.
And Mandela.
And Abu Jamal.
And Mandela's too.
And Mandela, the whole South Africa. And I don't think it's the church, I think it's the people.
It's the people.
Who are taking on and recognizing the struggle.
You're right.
It's all the same.
And I had some Irish people come to Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And in Philadelphia, the people we were staying with were so bigoted. They had a little black kids, it was Halloween. Some little black kids came up for a candy. And the guy sitting at the table said, "Look at that, why don't they stay in their own goddamn neighborhood?" And the Irish people were with me, were looking at me. And one guy said, "Don't they realize that this is how the English are treating us in Ireland?"
Yeah.
I said, "No, they don't realize.
They don't realize.
These are American Irish." Anyway, mm-hmm. There is a distinction. And in Ireland, they were wonderful.
Yeah.
And they got themselves in a lot of trouble, too, because they embraced Palestine.
Ah,
and
sure.
They got up and said, any occupation, mm-hmm. we're against any. And all of a sudden, they were saying politically incorrect things.
Well, we're against occupation, but not in this case.
Yeah, some occupations are more equal than others.
Exactly, but
And in fact, I'm going to sum this up, because the reason I think we have to be a little bit belligerent, I think we have to wear a half shirt. We let things go by. The great Bush was asked about evolution, and he said, "The jury's still out on that." I said, "Well, we laugh at this guy. Oh, you're so funny, Georgie." But he's not funny. This is serious stuff.
Yeah.
And he's got a group out there he's talking to. When the first, they started the war in Iraq, he used the word crusade. That wasn't a mistake. The word crusade was to a special group out there that he was talking to. These are the people in power. These are the people that scare me. The recent poll in 2005, 45% of the people surveyed accept the Genesis account of creation. 37% of the public and 45% of those who voted for Bush believe creationism should replace evolution in our schools.
Yeah.
All over the country now, the school boards are having battles. I was in a play, Madison Theater Guild, it was called Inherit the Wind, and I played Brian. And my son played the kid who learned evolution. It was a fun play. And at the end of the play, Darrow purportedly says to Scopes, "Do you think it's over?" "It's not over." And he was right. That we're talking about 1925. It's not over. Evolution battles are still going on. Other battles we don't... The Ten Commandment battle. I would laugh at these things, except the judge who got kicked off the bench became a hero and might someday become governor of the state. He's the guy who had the Ten Commandment monument, I don't know how many tons, in his courthouse. And he is a great hero. Is it Alabama or one of those wonderful dysfunctional states? But he's a great hero down there. And this Ten Commandment, prayer in our schools is such a big thing. Again, I don't know what prayer, and I don't know who's going to pray or how, but we used to say we could go to the U.S. Supreme Court and that we have a fair shot with our Bill of Rights. Now we do not have a fair shot. And I'm sorry to say that the bozos up there were picked for the right reason, and they're so reactionary, and one by one, they just turned down some poor woman who had a suit for wages, discriminatory wages, and they just turned it down. For years she had been discriminated against, that she hadn't filed timely enough or something.
6 months.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, they were looking for ways.
Sure.
That is the court we have today. We're not going to get our answers from the court for a while. We're going to get our answers from the Senate. And from the U.S. Senate. There we have a chance. There we will have debates. There we will have some balance. But one of the things you and I can start working on is this gerrymandering of the system. I never did understand it. I accepted it. But the gerrymandering of the system works to our detriment and to the empowerment of the conservatives and the religious right. And that's the electoral system.
Yeah.
after two elections, we pissed and moaned about how unfair the electoral system, how some little state no bigger than a thumbnail can have the same power as Texas or California, how they can have two senators, and Texas has two senators, and California has two. How do they get these votes? Well, how does the electoral vote come about? How can a man win the presidency and lose the presidency because of the electoral vote? There should be reform. I'm not saying doing away with it. Nobody's even looking at it. There may be some committee groups, but there's no, none of us, or there's no big surge. That's a bad word. The surge. We use the word surge and we all get put uniforms on.
It's a milking machine, isn't it?
Yeah, but we should be fighting for electoral reform. We should be looking at that kind of stuff. We should be battling, too, for, you know, the, I have to admire the Republicans. They so believe that there's election fraud. And there is. But it's not the election fraud they want to stop. They want to get, they got some woman convicted in Milwaukee who signed up for voting rights, who thought she was taking a driver's license. She didn't know, and she went to jail. That's the kind of fraud they want to go after. They don't want to go after Florida. They didn't want to go look at Ohio. They didn't want to look at machines that register votes for the other guy. This is the kind of stuff. Now, I realize I'm off religion, but it's so intertwined now. It comes down to power, because whenever I hear somebody who wants to hurt somebody in the name of God, whenever I hear persons using God's name to justify what they're doing, if you dig down deep enough, it's money and power. It has nothing to do with God. It has money and power. And God is used as the man or thing or whatever who's justifying this whole thing. The battle, oh, this is a whole new area. There's two people I'll just leave you with. One is my favorite bigot. Bill O'Reilly talks about the war against Christmas. Now, I didn't know that we went to war against Christmas. I said, you know, I was part of the war against drugs, the war against crime, and the war against poverty. The war against poverty is the only one we won. We beat the hell out of those people. But now they got the war against immigrants. We also got a war against Christmas. I said, wow, you know. And of course, Bush tells us we got a war against everybody. But the man I liked, a man like Upton Sinclair, he wrote a book called It Can't Happen Here. I don't know whether this quote was in there, but he had a quote in which he said, when fascism comes, it will be wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross. So I think the guy is so, because it really makes me so angry. I gotta be angry, sorry. But I go to Washington and I walk in to see these congressmen and they all got the little flag on, and I don't. I walked in with an Irish and American flag on. I was not gonna wrap myself in their flag. They've stolen the flag from us. They are waving that thing back and forth. They are patriots and you are scum. And that makes me mad, because I have a right. I just won't wave it as much. I don't believe in promiscuous patriotism, and I won't wave it as much as they do. And that makes me a traitor, or makes me something else. And if I dare criticize what's going on, I am a traitor. Well, I'm 70 years old. What the hell? Why not? I could be a traitor at this period of my life. It took me a long time to get there. I might as well do it. But I'm going to join your group because I think you're a bunch of traitors, and I would like to be part of your activities. And I thank you. I know that there may be some other questions, but before you get to them, I'll thank you for letting me talk.
Yeah.
Well, Andy, it's always fun to hear you talk, but I don't think we ought to let these people define the language. They're capturing the language, and we shouldn't let them get away with it.
And how do you stop them?
For example, what terms would you...
Yeah, get some examples.
Well, and you put me on the spot, I'm not putting a finger on the...
Faith-based?
Or being Christian-based.
Faith-based drives me nuts. I mean, faith-based is just the word that goes with everything now, and it's like...
What's that mean?
I have no idea what it means, but you hear repeatedly here this faith-based...
Initiative.
Faith-based initiative.
We'll do this in the name of democracy. Go throw over a country, take over and occupy it, and give them democracy.
Yeah, it's a good thing because we know what's good for you and we're going to give you this, so therefore we're doing the right thing.
Giving you freedom.
But I think the Christian nation concept also.
Absolutely, and if we're supposed to be a diverse nation, respecting everybody, no matter what his or her religion or point of view is, and here we are supporting a theocracy that we say we're putting we're instituting democracy in Iraq. And what we're instituting is a theocracy.
Well, Andy brought up the activist judge term, which really is saying, why didn't that judge find the Constitution to be just an inconvenience?
Mm-hmm. Well, they use the term activist judge to determine, to describe the kind of activities they don't like.
Right.
But what they have now are activist judges. Pushing their point of view on everybody else. They're much more activist than the ones they pilloried.
When Robert Weissel put out the book in the year, he pointed out that the Republican-appointed judge in Dover was thought to be the darling of the right, but he became an activist judge when
Jones.
He came down with the ruling. That was
Jones, great ruling. Beat the hell out of the creationists. Spent a long time chiding them for even bringing the case, and school board for being stupid that they didn't even understand.
Our speaker pointed out, however, that although that is a fine court decision, is going to set precedent for a long while, it somehow missed catching the majority of the people's hearts and minds. Because they're still going, I mean, every year they take polls and it's a high percentage of people who believe in creationism. Yeah. Over evolution.
Because their propaganda machine is going full tilt.
Yeah.
It was interesting when back in the fall when my daughter was looking, started looking at colleges, and she was looking at slightly swindling, say 5,000 student range, not big schools. And I would easily say that 75% of the schools that ended up in her, she started out with saying, finding schools that had the majors she was interested in size, 75% of them, what we started doing was reading the mission statement. The mission statement had Jesus Christ or God in it. She eliminated the school, and she eliminated it. It was like she was finding maybe 1 in 20 schools that didn't have it. I mean, I was amazed at how many small colleges, and I mean, I could give you a list with, she started with a list of 75 schools, and she eliminated 3/4 of them because in the actual mission statement for the school, some said this is Judeo-Christian, but they said the goal is to help the students firm their Christian goals and their belief of this country toward God. And this is, we weren't looking for religion major here, she's in sports management, but there's a big link between the most of the schools that teach sports management have those as majors are religious-based schools.
Wow. You know, but one has to realize that most of your small schools, you said 5,000?
Oh, you know, under 10.
I mean, most small schools are private schools. Your state-supported schools are large institutions. Mm-hmm. So, and most private schools are religious schools.
Or originally.
A lot of them were originally founded, like you look at Knox and Beloit and Lawrence, and a lot of those schools were back in the 1800s were religious-based, but they don't have, the mission statement may say, be a good citizen, be a scholar, be a good citizen, but they don't specifically in the 1, 2, 3 for the mission saying, bring you closer to the goals of a life led by God type of thing, and these schools did. And they weren't religious schools. I mean, they weren't listed as being religious schools, like Loras and some of the other Loras, which is in.
You want to do another range on it?
Yeah.
Take a look at the mission statements of retirement homes.
Ooh.
You want another group that's similar problem?
Yeah.
Well, I'm supposed to go in and get a new hip, and one of the things I asked my doctor is I wanted to get his philosophy. I wanted to know if he believed, because I believe that we weren't made in the image of God. God was made in the image of us. And so I want to have a God-like hip when I get through.
And he promised he would.
He did. Yeah. He said I could walk on water when I left here.
I'd be a little suspicious.
Designed by an intelligent designer.
From how was the intelligent designer designed, by the way?
Well,
it's much too complex to have been, to exist without an intelligent designer.
One of the questions Robert had in the service he gave was not just intelligent design, but who is the intelligent designer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One thing that disturbs me is you hear this often from the religious right, that a person, you know, cannot live a good life and so on without the approval of God or the disapproval of God, that only that would keep you in line rather than the desire for a good society. You know, who would want to live in a society where theft is commonplace all over, you know? I think you sign on to these things in the struggle for a good society, for equality and so on, and not you know, some of these ideas have come down from religion, but they're also in philosophy, you know, they're in our legal system. It's not just, you know, fear of damnation and so on that would keep people straight. It seems to me, you know, that a positive approach is much more
also our political
one.
System, because
yeah,
we do have theft all the time. If you're an anarchist, property is theft.
Oh well, but I mean, we have a lot of legal things in place to deter this as well. It's not just, you know, just belief in some punishing God.
I think that's one reason that it's very important for people who are atheists to speak out when they have the opportunity, and not just kind of keep quiet when the conversation comes around to them. It's sort of like being gay and lesbian. For so many years, so many people would stay quiet, and nobody, the average person, had no notion that a lot of people were gay and lesbian, and a lot of decent people. And then it's now, they have no notion that so many people are atheists. And it seems to me it's important to speak out.
And the survey they did at the University of Minnesota, I think it was, found out that the person you wouldn't want your daughter to marry or live next to, the atheist, was at the bottom, worse than gay and lesbian.
I believe it, yeah. And they have no idea that, and like you said, that an atheist would have any moral compunctions about anything, because they just can't understand how you can live without the carrot and stick.
Because they've grown up with religious propaganda.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's that. I think it's from a very early age of convincing. I mean, we spend our time here at UU convincing our children that they have free thought, that they're in charge of what they think and they're in charge of what they learn. But that isn't the attitude that a lot of kids are given. It's as if, you know, you cannot do this on your own. You do not have the ability as a human being to make all these good decisions and make these right choices. You need to have the church, you need to have God. Just, they have to show you the way, because without it, you're just going to be a common, worthless common criminal or something, mm-hmm. because you don't have that inside. Rather than building up and saying, you have all those building blocks to be this, you are a good person, and guide them in that direction. It's like, it's the whole basis to me of confirmations and confessions and everything else. It's as if they're not capable. You've got to have that overseeing all the time, or else you'd go wrong.
But what he had to say was that what you talk about that and the duty of the parents like you, it seems to me, is to teach your children where it's safe to say that.
Where what? Where it's safe. Teach your children where it's safe to say something like that. That's true.
One of the times I got in trouble with a priest, my last year at St. John's University in New York, and I really tried so hard to be a good kid. I sat in the front row and they brought this priest in from Princeton, New Jersey. He was the chaplain. He was a Dominican priest. His name is Father Hugh Hall. And he made a talk, and the gist of his talk came down to this. You young men and women are ready to now to go to graduate school. Please make sure you pick a Catholic graduate school or you will lose your faith. So I waited, and I just raised my little hand, and I couldn't keep my mouth. I said, Father, I'm looking over this sheet. It says, you went to Oxford, you're chaplain at Princeton, you went to Harvard. How come you didn't lose your faith? Oh, God. Terrible, terrible silence, And then he came out with something about how the Holy Spirit or Holy Ghost or Holy something. I made sure he didn't lose his soul, but he wouldn't take care of me. The whole idea was the hypocrisy, but this is the bullshit that they kept feeding to us, Even, I didn't find this out till much later, that I was in a Jesuit high school. And I went from there to the Sisters of Charity for the last 2 years at high school in New Jersey. I didn't realize, somebody
not
told
the
me.
One I taught in.
No, this is Englewood. The a guy told me he tried, he was at St. Francis Xavier, where I went, Jesuit school. He tried to go to a secular or non-Catholic or whatever you want to call it, university. And the Jesuits would not send his transcript. I said, what? He said, what power? They would not send the kid's high school transcript to Harvard, Yale, whatever the hell it was, because it was not. I said, what power? Now we could sue the hell out of him. Thank God for trial lawyers. But that's the kind of thought, that you'd wonder where they get this power. Boy, they exercise it.
So it was the bottom line. You think that most religious propaganda is really has to do with power in the hands of particular religious groups, like Catholics, Muslims, or whatever.
I think it's an innate thing in every religion. One, we are the true religion. You got to start off with that idea. We are the true religion. Two, all other religions are false. Three, anything we can do to protect that doctrine is okay. Four, we've got to keep our people safe. And that's where this power, and we've got to have the money coming in, and we've got to have the power over them. In Ireland, for years, they kept those poor people believing. Ireland was the most sexually repressed country in Europe. And it wasn't until 20 years ago they decided, the hell with it. We're going to have divorce, we're going to have abortion, we're going to have contraceptives. They had a contraceptive plant in Dublin that made contraceptives that could not be sold in Ireland. They had to ship them out to Europe. I mean, this is how bad. And the church ran everything. But now the church is not in the catbird seat, and they've been resigned to taking it. But they still, 95% of the people in Ireland are Catholic.
Well, there was a Jewish mayor in Dublin at one point.
He was Jewish. Kind of Briscoe, Robert Briscoe, yeah. But there's a difference between Catholic and practicing. Because like in Northern Ireland, you would be labeled, whether you wanted it or not, depending on where you lived and who your parents were. You're Catholic, you're Protestant. Guy might never go to church in his life, he's Catholic. But that's
the
way.
You mean the propaganda is related to the money? power, not necessarily some of these rules that the church makes, like in Venezuela today, they're telling people if you have AIDS, you cannot go to communion. Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they come up with this stuff. There was one cardinal who was telling.
Would you want to drink out of the communion cup when
was a
someone
cardinal.
With AIDS had just drank out?
I
have
to get a little in the Catholic Church, get a little host. That's it.
That's the whole. But don't you still drink the wine
no.
from the?
No, you do not. But there was some cardinal who was telling people. That the companies were putting little holes in contraceptives so that you could get AIDS.
I mean,
this is the kind of bullshit they're putting out. You know, where does it come from? Do these people believe this?
I was told because they were sent. They
I don't know. I don't know where Bill Frist, did he really believe you could get AIDS from tears? I mean, this was a medical doctor. You know,
yeah.
He was on the comedy channel trying to answer that. It was hilarious.
I think he took his training at Bob Jones or something like that.
I just like to put one thought out there too. That I think that there are more people like that would like to have these kinds of discussions, but they're so part of the integrated Christian mm-hmm. community that they have these discussions at their church. Mm-hmm. And that they might have the same beliefs, like they question whether there's a God, or they question. I think it's very more common than maybe
we know.
And when people take a survey, of course they're going to say they believe in God because they're indoctrinated into their church, even though they might have self-question. So I'm just wondering whether it, in addition to getting a little bit agitated and protesting some things, these kinds of groups should be more prevalent. They should be more common. They should allow people the opportunity to get out and talk about these things in an alternate way instead of always at their church, because a lot of their ideas wouldn't be as open to
the other place it used to happen was in the in our dormitories in college.
Right.
And then after you left, you had, you know, all these talks about what is there a God? What
that's
is
where you were losing
life?
Your faith.
Right, that is the losing your faith. Yeah. But then after we graduate, we go back into these.
We get married, and you have kids,
well,
you
have
an obligation to raise your kids in a tradition and a moral system. And really the only more structural moral system out there are churches. So, you know, there really isn't any good alternative that I'm aware of.
We underestimate the role that grandparents play in watching their grandchildren.
Spoken like a grandparent.
Yeah. In
Christian. I'm glad you said what you did, because the new radio station, WIDE, we're going to have a series of low-power luncheons, and WORT can be the high-power luncheon with three martinis, but ours will be low-power. And it's really meant as a way for people to talk about things that they are interested in, you know, like you just said. And there's an old-fashioned term, I think, for this sort of thing that used to be called soirees. And maybe I'll keep you all informed of when we're going to have one. It should be towards the end of the month that we'll have our first one.
And this is an interesting radio station because it's going to be half Christian, so there'll be Christian propaganda coming during their half of each day. And
then there'll be radical propaganda.
I want to add one thing at the end now. In case we think for some reason that these people don't have power, we had in New York, we had a man named Anthony Comstock. I don't know where he came from. The pride he had in putting Mae West in jail because she made innuendos. She was a dirty woman. Anthony Comstock ran New York, and they had the anti-vice thing. And, you know, he watched everything, literature. They wouldn't let Ulysses come in, you know. Then we come down and we say, oh, that's 1920. We had an attorney general who ran around saying, I have no king but Jesus, and then he would put cloths
over
on
the
bus in Washington.
Yeah.
So when you think I'm exaggerating this stuff, they are nuts, but they got power. I mean, John Ashcroft was, he had no king but Jesus. The Jesus didn't want him. He told me, I got a call. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The books are going around. If you want to take a look at them.
Our next meeting will be at the Sox City Multi-Congregation Gathering. I think it's going to be July 29th. So I don't know if anybody wants to propose a program for that. We can just have an informal discussion and let people know that the Humanist Union is there to find out about humanism.
Doesn't it work better if you have some topic at least that people can talk about, even though you don't have...
Well, it's sort of an add-on to the regular program there during the picnic afterwards.
Yeah, it's but the picnic afterwards for the... Yeah. It's just that if you leave it open to discussion, you just kind of get it. A lot of
people. Oh, exciting. Would you like to volunteer to lead the discussion?
Yeah.
Sure. Well, we would have just been through 4th of July, so you can reflect on.
That's a good
idea.
Well, I mean, you can reflect on. Well, I'd love to have more discussion about. Remember that program, Sarah? Not Sarah Lord. Sarah, somebody gave a program a couple years ago about the flag,
yes.
The U.S. flag, and talked
Sarah
about
Oliver.
The fascism of saluting a piece of fabric, pledging allegiance.
Mm.
I love to. I have a couple of buttons that are the American flag, and I wear them upside down.
Yeah.
And I just wish more people would notice that, because I feel that that's a legitimate way to protest.
That's a strange phrase, isn't it? Pledge allegiance to the flag.
Exactly.
Literally, you listen and think about it.
There are an awful lot of people who come in as adults, as new citizens to the U.S., and they're astounded.
They're coming.
Well, the first thing they come in and
come again.
Little flags. And I'll bet you don't see any turning them down, because how would they dare? They're brand new citizens. They might take it away from them. The citizenship, not the flag.
Well, your new member will not, Andrew Summers will not be there because he's getting a new hip on August
26th.
Yeah.
Well, July.
He will be there in July.
July.
That's going to be a national holiday.
We'll pray.
Andy. UW. Squire. He's a faith based.
Andy,
we wouldn't want to do that.
We'll pray for you.
Pray for him. Oh, you know, it's funny. It's not funny, but my brother died. And after that, I got a card from some society telling me, they got the names mixed up, that there were these prayers that are going to be said for the repose of my soul for the next 4 years. I had these prayers. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm not going to turn it down. I'm not that great a believer, but what the hell, I'm not going to turn it down. So there's some group praying for me now somewhere.
And your brother missed out.
There was a research study.
Well, what the hell. He led a good life. He didn't know.
You know, somebody did a survey of how patients did in hospitals, if they were prayed for or not. And the ones who were prayed for didn't use.
Yeah. Right.
A lot of people would not believe those results, I'm certain.
The other day I was pulling my car and just as I got it, I opened my car door, this young woman.